This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics. BioGaia Protectus Baby Drops with Vitamin D is an award-winning 2-in-1 probiotic baby supplement containing high-quality lactic acid bacterium Lactobacillus reuteri, which is clinically proven to reach the gut alive. Designed for babies, it comes in a convenient squeezable tube for simple and precise dosage. These drops also contain vitamin D, essential for normal function of the immune system and the growth and development of bones in children. I recommend BioGaia probiotic drops to a lot of my babies that suffer from colic and reflux, as it is the most researched probiotic for infant colic in the world. Welcome to the Baby Tribe Podcast, your essential companion through the journey of parenting. I'm Professor Afif Al-Kafash, a neonatologist, pediatrician, researcher, and lactation consultant at the Rotunda Hospital Dublin and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
And I'm Katie Mugan, a pediatric and public health nurse and a lactation consultant. Together, with over 40 years of experience in caring for infants and children, we're here to share expert insights, inspiring stories, and give you access to an amazing array of experts in parenting and the field of pediatrics.
Before we dive into today's topic, remember to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform. Your ratings and reviews help us reach more parents like you, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Now, let's get started with today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Baby Tribe Podcast. We are now episode 10 of season 3.
I can't believe we're actually into season 3.
I know. We're now doing this a year and a half.
We're dating that long.
This is the longest relationship I've had.
Outside of your marriage.
Outside of
outside
my marriage.
Outside the 17 years.
I know. Outside of the 17 years. It's a very, very long time. Two children. And you have four, though.
Yeah, six together.
I know. We've got six kids between
us. We're blended.
Half a football team.
God, jeez, yeah.
I know, it's absolutely insane. And I always go back and remember how we treated our kids differently from the firstborn to the secondborn. We were chatting just before we came to record this about the things that we used to do and how different they were between child one and child two, three and four in your case as well.
Just kept on going, Afif.
Because I remember how neglected my second was. I can only imagine how number four feels in your household.
Dragged up. Like, I honestly sometimes think he may be feral. Like, he just, oh, do you know what? He's gorgeous. He's his own person. But I will say, when I look at the first, and we were so perfect in so many ways. Like, I think as a nurse, you're very routined. But I remember Luke didn't get not even a snippet of chocolate before. On his second birthday, we did a birthday cake, and that's when he had his first bit of chocolate. On my fourth, I'd say, God knows, he was definitely under one.
So with my daughter, other than the hiccup of, God rest his soul, her granddad offering her a cone of ice cream when she was 4 months old, sitting in a baby chair, just kind of sort of chilling, walked in and she was holding one of these mini ice cream cones and licking it like mad. of course, it was Anne's dad, so I couldn't say anything. So I just looked at Anne, pointed at the ice cream, and she went ballistic. And he was like, but sure, just give her a small taste. Other than that, she didn't taste anything until she was two, I think. But sure, my son then.
Yeah.
Like, she'd be having chocolate, and that he's just taking stuff off her and feeding. And then also the fact that, both doctors, my daughter, the kind of slightest whiff of a sniffle, and I'd be like straight into the emergency room saying, can you check her out? She's dying. But then my son, like, he really had to prove his injuries before we would take him to
We were terrible. We were like, well, we weren't. I am very much, unless my kids are nearly at death's door, do I turn up at the GP. Now, I had two really bad
asthmatics. Even at the first?
Yeah, well, Luke would have been a really bad asthmatic. Yeah, I do remember getting into trouble for being too late bringing him in when he was really bad chesty. But I wasn't as bad. But then Jim on the other side was probably, you know, he was the other side of me. So I was kind of extreme to going one way and he'd be like, no, we need to get them checked. So he was probably my level of sense going, Katie, if this was any other child, what would you say? He's giving out to me now, I'm tapping the table. What would he say? What would you do? And I was like, go in. So we go in. But I do remember, and I shouldn't really say this on camera, but Jim still slags me over this. Our third got skates and he was three. So they were the Fisher Price skates. You know, you put them on over your shoe. We went out in a walk. This was just at COVID, or maybe it was COVID. Maybe it was just before COVID. And we went out. Now, we didn't get to the end of the road when he fell over. And he was kind of dramatic. You know, he is by nature kind of dramatic. So he started crying. And I was like, oh God, he must have really hurt himself. But he couldn't walk. And he was like, no, my foot. And so we went back and he sat down and he was crying. And we said, look, give him Calpol, give him the Nurofen. Like, he's probably just hurt it. And I said, Jim goes, should we get it checked in? And I was like, no, leave it go. Like, he'd be grand in a few, like, let's see how it goes. We left it overnight. The next day, he's not weight bearing at all.
Oh no.
Went in, he had a broken leg.
Oh no.
Ended up in cast. Wow. And then a boot.
That's pretty impressive.
It was, yeah. So Jim actually still says, do you remember the time you left your kid for like 12 hours with a broken leg? And I was like, well, it wasn't that bad that, okay, no, there's no, I can't even go there. Like, yeah.
The time I'll never be allowed to forget was when I think Anne was on call and Maggie was maybe four and we were just playing outside. She just learned how to ride a bike, right? And she was so proud of herself going around on her bike in front of the house. And she had four loose teeth at the front of her mouth that were driving her insane. And I remember she was cycling around a bit wobbly and I got distracted doing something else, probably watching the other child who, you know, constantly was trying to kill himself. And then I turn around and she's on the floor in tears, four front teeth gone all at once. And she kind of stood up with this horrendously looking bloody face, because you know the way it can get really, really bloody. And I put a very positive spin on it. I was like, Maggie, these teeth were bothering you for 4 weeks now and they're all gone. And look how much money you're going to get from the Tooth Fairy. You know, the Tooth Fairy rates went up dramatically that day. Mm-hmm. They went up from about €2 a tooth to about €5 a tooth. So she got a substantial sum that evening.
And how did Anne react when she walked home to see her child had no front teeth?
She was equally aghast and impressed at the same time. I would say, well, they were bothering her, you know. So she's got wonderful teeth now, but yeah.
Yeah, so all I say is if you're a medical practitioner or come from a nursing background, just look after your kids.
Speaking of medical practitioners, we have an amazing interview with you today with Professor Orla Franklin, who is a pediatric cardiologist. Yes. She is one of my mentors. She is one of my superheroes.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. She mentored me during my training, but we're going to talk all about heart disease in children and the importance of cardiovascular health. So this is an interview for everybody. Mm-hmm. More about that later. But in the interim, myself and Katie, we're going to chat about two different things. We're going to chat about how to navigate the healthcare service in a community setting with your child, because it can be confusing.
Yeah.
And I also have a nerdy segment.
Oh, he loves his nerdy segment.
Going to the navigating the healthcare system for your child, when your child is well, a lot of people, especially I see a lot of overseas people.
Yeah,
that come into my clinic. And one thing they always say to me is there are no community pediatricians in Ireland. We are used to, from maybe seeing family and friends or having other older kids when they were somewhere else, that they get followed up by a pediatrician in the community. And that model doesn't exist here. And believe it or not, some countries follow up kids by a pediatrician every month, which I think is a bit of overkill.
Every month?
Yeah, every month. That's, I think it's a bit
too much.
It's a bit much.
No.
Yeah, I'm sure they mostly track growth and things like that. But we don't have that system here. We have a public health nurse system that we did go through, by the way, in season two. So you can always go back and have a listen to see exactly what your child get in the schedule. But Katie's going to maybe give us a quick rundown of that and what to do if problems arise.
Yeah, so basically your GP is kind of the head of the care and they will look after you by doing the 2-week check and the 6-week check. Obviously, every child under the age of 6 gets a free GP card. So once your baby's born, you get the PPS number, register them ASAP, and then they will be free for any consultations that you require through the GP. Your PHN, your public health nurse, then will actually look after you and they will see you at birth until all issues, there's no issues at all. If you've had any concerns about weight or feeding or anything else, you can link back in with your PHN at any time. They will see you at 3 months, 9 months to 11 months, 24, in around 22 to 24 months, and a 3 to 4 year group. So that's kind of 4 extra checks. Outside of that, if there is something that is concerning you with regards to speech and language, with regards to occupational therapy, if you have a concern about growth or that, then the public health nurse can refer you to directly either to the AMO, which is the area medical officer, who is a medical doctor that is specialised in development, and they can actually see and assess. Even with regards to hips, they can do rapid access then and back into the hospital for x-rays and things like that if required. But also they can refer straight direct to the speech and language therapy service, to the occupational therapy, physio, community pediatric physios, your pediatric dietitians. So there's an awful lot of services under the umbrella of the public health nursing service that you can avail of should you need it. If your child is unwell and you go into the hospital, your child will be seen as required, as in if they are in need of something ASAP, they will be seen. So there's no real requirement for public versus private within the hospital setting.
So Katie, a lot of parents wonder about what to do with their baby if they're unwell following discharge from a maternity hospital. And by and large, really, if your baby's unwell or if you're worried about the baby, it's the GP or the emergency room. How urgent you are seen will really depends on the baby's condition. Babies are triaged. Even children are triaged according to how urgently they need to be seen. And if your baby is unwell, for whatever reason, they will be seen quickly and sorted out quickly. So that's an important thing to do. The other thing parents wonder is whether they can see a pediatrician privately for routine follow-up. And there are some places that can offer a service like that. But just to be aware that, again, the majority of care is still left in the community, as Katie has described, whereas a pediatrician may track your baby's growth and do developmental checks more routinely than would happen in the community service. You know, it is not something that is necessary for well, healthy, normal growing children. So I don't want people to feel that they are missing out on anything by not having the community pediatrics service here.
But I think the one thing you have pointed out, that if you've got concerns and you just want maybe a second opinion or you don't know where to navigate, then there is always the option of the private pediatrician if you choose to.
Yeah. And, you know, you always check and see how much they charge, because it can vary from service to service as well. If you have health insurance, some of them are covered. Yeah. You know, some visits to private pediatricians can be covered as well. So you can need to check with your insurer as well. One thing that I'm asked a lot as well, Katie, is what to bring to your GP or your pediatrician before your visit, or anything that might be helpful for parents to prepare before a visit.
Well, I suppose for the GP, it just depends on why you're turning up there. If your baby's unwell, then I suppose kind of just having an idea of what's been going on in the previous time. So sometimes if it's towards weight or growth, then looking at having all the weights documented for any weight checks that you've had previous. If you're turning up with a baby that's unwell, sometimes, like I'm sure you see it all the time, my baby's twitching or they're doing something, I always say capture it by video so that the pediatrician or the GP can then actually see it. If it's a rash, obviously you're turning up with something very visible. So it just depends, I suppose, on what you're turning up with, whether it's development or whether there's an illness.
Taking photos is actually, I personally really, really like it. Yep. When parents show me photographs of the thing that they're concerned about, be it a funny noise that a baby's making,
yep,
or a funny movement, if they can capture it. And sometimes people are shy of showing me pictures of their baby's poo. Never be worried, especially if you're worried about maybe blood or mucus. If you are, yep, worried about an intolerance, taking a picture of that would be very, very helpful. And that can help us then, you know, because it sometimes can be hard to verbalize the symptoms.
Yeah.
You know,
and I would say videos can show an awful lot, because sometimes, and I have had experience of this, in that a parent will say something and I'll go, that doesn't sound normal. And I say, take a video, but it mightn't happen again for quite a while. But when they show it to a clinician, they will actually say, no, we're going to hold on to this baby and just see when, if it does happen again or, you know, whatever's going on. So videos are brilliant. Photos, fantastic.
Yeah. Anyway, hope you found this short roundup very, very helpful.
CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver three essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
So, Katie, let's pause for a moment to remind our listeners that Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, and we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Head Stuff Plus.
That's right, Afif. Our spin-off series, Keeping Up with the Kafashians, hosted by you and your lovely wife, Anne Doherty, treats our listeners to the fabulous husband and wife discussions, an expansion of points raised here on the Baby Tribe, and some science as well.
So please subscribe for as little as €5 per month and make sure to select Baby Tribe and Keeping Up with the Kafashians as your podcasts to support. Subscribing will give you access to all the bonus content on Headstuff Plus. And guys, Katie's weekly appearance fees are getting a bit much for me, so we'd really value your support.
I wish everyone. Afif's skincare routine is ridiculous. You should see the potions and lotions he uses every single day.
Listen, it takes a lot to look this good. Thank you to everyone who have subscribed so far. And if you haven't subscribed yet, why the hell not?
So we are going to talk about Afif's nerdy segment now. And guys, you won't believe what he's including in it. Afif, the microbiome.
Yeah.
How many have we gotten through without you mentioning it?
I don't think we've had one episode go through without me mentioning
that
the microbiome.
That word has not come up. It will be on his epitaph.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this study is actually really interesting because, again, another Irish study. Ireland actually does a lot of great pediatric research, sometimes leading the world in innovations like this. And it's really lovely to be able to showcase it. But I'm not talking about the study for the sake of it. This is actually an interesting study that challenges the traditional thinking that, you know, being exposed to the environment can help reduce the risk of allergy down the line. So this was a study that was done uniquely during COVID. And really the authors of the study, one of whom is Professor Jonathan Horahan, who was on our podcast.
Brilliant.
Yeah, on our podcast last season talking about food allergies, had the foresight of examining the children's microbiome when they're growing through the pandemic. And what was special and relevant about the pandemic is the fact that our exposure to various environments and exposure to various individuals went down significantly. So what the authors wanted to do is compare the makeup of the microbiome in babies that grew up during the pandemic, where they had very little exposure to varying environments and varying people, and comparing it to a group of babies that grew up prior to the pandemic, where they also had snapshots of their microbiome in the baby's poo, to see if the change in social interaction and the change in environmental exposure actually made a difference to the microbiome and whether that actually affected the incidence of allergies down the line. Because the thinking that if you're not exposed to a variety of environmental situations and you're not exposed to a variety of individuals, then your immune system will not be tested as much and you are more likely to develop allergies down the line.
Interesting.
That's fair to say. Yeah. That's what we sort of think, isn't that right? What the paper did basically was investigate the association between the gut microbiome development and allergy in infants born during the pandemic when there was social distancing restrictions and all of that. What they did was they looked at poo samples at 6 months and 12 months. And they compared those poo samples with babies that they had similar poo sample timelines before the pandemic. And what they found was actually quite interesting. There was a relative abundance of what we call as bifidobacteria, while the environmentally transmitted bacteria such as Clostridia was lower. Okay, so they did find that the bacteria that comes from directly from the mother impacted by breastfeeding were higher during COVID times. And the bacteria that you tend to get from the environment was actually lower during COVID times. And that would make intuitive sense in that, yes, you're less exposed to bacteria from the environment around you. And as a result, those bacteria aren't as represented in your gut's microbiome. So the thinking was that might actually make you more likely to be allergic if you're not exposed to varying bacteria. But they actually did not find that. What they found was that there was no increased risk of allergies during COVID when they compared to the risk of allergies prior to the pandemic. And what they concluded was maybe exposure to environment isn't as important in developing allergies down the line as the bacteria that you get from your direct environment. What they actually found, which I found was really, really interesting, they actually found that breastfeeding and exposure to more plant-based diets once you wean from breastfeeding had a big impact on reducing the risk of allergy down the line.
Really?
Yeah.
Plant-based?
Plant-based. Nuts, legumes, and things like that. Interestingly, the foods that we used to associate with allergy, for developing allergy down the line.
So the more they're exposed to it, the better?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
They had a better bacteria profile in their gut, and as a result, less risk of allergy.
But not just plant-based. Is it just the addition to them?
Yeah, so you don't just go on plant-based.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, so more plant-based foods was associated with less. Of course, you need your protein and things like that and from protein sources. They actually also found that a family history of allergy still had the biggest impact on a child developing allergy, but also smoking. So if there was smoking in the household during the first crucial 6 to 12 months, then the risk of allergy goes up as well.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mode of delivery. One thing that people always consider as a big contributor to the microbiome down the line only contributed 3% of the variation of the microbiome at 6 months and only 1.5% of the variation at 12 months. So all these mums that feel guilty for delivering via C-section and are told that the baby did not get their good bacteria because of a C-section, it's completely bogus. And several studies have actually shown that.
Yeah.
And this is what really irks me about the new formulas that are coming out. Again, adding more guilt to mums and whatnot. So mode of delivery, when you take everything else into consideration, breastfeeding, diet, doesn't have a huge impact on a baby's microbiome down the line. And that's an important message to actually send out. We know that bifidobacteria is one of the good bacteria that are there. And having more bifidobacteria reduces your risk of allergy. And you get more of that from the things that we talked about. Direct feeding, breastfeeding, plant-based diets is a big contributor as well. So even if you formula fed, if you then introduce a lot of plant-based foods once you wean, that will favor the microbiome towards a much better bacterial profile. Receiving antibiotics over the first 12 months also negatively impacted the gut microbiome towards the more sort of allergy type rather than the healthy type. But again, antibiotics are necessary, and the use of antibiotics can be offset by adopting the more healthy approaches as well that I've just outlined there.
And if you incorporated, or did they look at if you incorporated a probiotic in like two formula fed infants? I know we've looked at studies before that has kind of proven that it's more beneficial. And I suppose post antibiotics, we always recommend a probiotic.
So this study did not look at that specifically. Okay. And the role of probiotics in actually reducing the risk of allergy, in offsetting the change in the gut microbiome following antibiotics, this data on that is emerging.
Yeah.
And I think that on balance, it's worth trying in babies rather than not trying, because we know they are safe.
Yeah.
And we know there are certain strains, especially the Lactobacillus reuteri strain, may have some favorable impacts on the baby's gut and also their clinical outcome in terms of reducing fussiness and also maybe challenging the risk of allergy down the line. So it's something worth exploring.
Yeah.
Now, wasn't this worth discussing?
It was. I love these studies, Afif.
There you go.
Especially when the microbiome comes into it.
I think the microbiome is central to a lot of our health, especially as adults as well.
And I think we know that now. Like, there's more and more studies coming out.
One thing that is coming out over and over and over again is the best way to look after your microbiome, both as a child and as an adult, is food diversity.
Yeah.
Not eating the same thing over and over and over again. Eating as much varied foods as possible.
You do have kids.
Yes. Afif.
You know, when they stick to the same foods every time, you can put as many things on the plate as you want. Will they eat them?
And guess what? We will be talking about this at a future episode of The Baby Tribe. But that's what the data shows. You need to have diversity in your foods.
That's it for today, Afif. We are going to move on to your interview, I was going to say, with our very special guest, Orla Franklin.
Orla, thank you so much for joining us on The Baby Tribe podcast. I'm so delighted that you are here. As I said in the intro, you have been one of my mentors during my early years in training, And I'm so happy that you're actually here. So first of all, I'd love to ask you three questions, if that's okay.
Okay.
All at once. Tell us about pediatric cardiology and what that is. What got you interested in pediatric cardiology and the road you took to become a pediatric cardiologist?
Okay. I suppose pediatric cardiology is primarily about looking after children where the development of their heart has gone wrong, most commonly at a structural level. So in the womb, their heart simply hasn't developed along the lines that it should. It's created a structural technical problem with their heart and we need to put it right. And that essentially is the biggest part of our business, the biggest part of what we do over in Crumlin. And then to a lesser extent, we deal with a group of kids who, by virtue of their genetics, by virtue of their families, have inheritable disease. They have cardiomyopathies, they have rhythm problems. And these things have the potential to have significant adverse impacts on their health. And again, we help them to manage these and to make lifestyle choices. And we help them to modify the disease, both through their day-to-day living and also through the medication that we give them. I'm not sure when I decided I wanted to become a pediatric cardiologist, but I suppose I was very attracted to the fact that it's a very tight specialty. You tend to see the patient yourself, you do and are responsible for the imaging yourself, you interpret that imaging, then you look the patient in the eye and you give them the results and the outcome of that imaging, often in the same consultation. So I think it's a rare experience for a patient to come into a consultation with a doctor to have all the tests done and to leave more or less knowing the answer, or at least be in a very good position in terms of understanding the answer. So I found that kind of tightness very attractive. Found the fact that I could do it, sort it, and they could leave with answers super attractive. But the problem for me when I was doing it was that there wasn't really a training scheme in Ireland. And so to pursue this interest, I had to go abroad. And I went to Oxford. I went to Oxford because I knew somebody through somebody else who might just give this Irish girl a job, might give me a chance. And so I found myself working in the John Radcliffe in Oxford, slightly intimidating in the 90s. It was an amazing place to be. I was given extraordinary opportunities. I probably shouldn't have been there. I'm not quite sure how I managed to talk my way into it. But I was able to bounce from Oxford then into Great Ormond Street because I thought, well, if I want to train in paediatric cardiology, I should go to Great Ormond Street and I should work there. And I did most of my training there, did 5 years of training there, and then I was appointed a consultant in Great Ormond Street. And I loved it. And I probably would still be there if I hadn't had kids. So I was completely career driven, completely focused, tunnel vision. And then I had a baby and that changed everything. Because suddenly our lovely centre of London lifestyle, just the two of us bopping around, working crazy hours, that had to stop, that had to change. And I also, my parents were getting older, things were changing in my life that made me think, you know what, this might be a good time to think about coming home. And I was really lucky. There are very few paediatric cardiologists in Ireland. And it happened that one of the godfathers of the subspecialty, Des Duff, was about to retire. So the guys came over from Dublin and they said to me, if Des retires, would you be interested in looking at the job? And so I found myself having been completely embedded in London and thinking I'd be in Great Ormond Street forever, giving really serious consideration to the fact that actually there was lots going on in my life now. And if I was going to get the balance right, it was a really good time to think about coming home. And so within 6 months, suddenly the two of us had managed to get jobs in Dublin and we came home with our toddler and we started again. And, to be honest, if you had asked me, was that going to be a good idea? I'm not sure I would have said it right. And in fact, I would say most days for the first 6 months we were here, I would quite happily have got on the ferry and gone back because the setup was different. There was lots about everything that was challenging. People didn't necessarily understand the kind of cardiology that I did because a lot of it hadn't been done before. And so at the beginning, there was lots going on. It was tricky, but we stayed and staying has been the best thing ever. This has been working in Dublin, working in Crumlin has been one of the most satisfying aspects of my life. And if I was to fill out my CAO form again tomorrow, I would say I would 100% want to do medicine. And I would definitely still want to become a pediatric cardiologist. And I think that it's a gift because there aren't too many people who can say that. There aren't too many people who, like, in their middle-aged years could go back and go, if I could do it all again, I'd do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And I would.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was there when you came, when you first came back. I was actually in my latter years of training, and I was going, rotating through cardiology. And you brought back an important skill in that MRI scanning of the heart. And I think a lot of people that are listening may associate MRI scanning with the brain. Not many realize probably that you can actually look at how the heart works via MRI.
Yeah, you can. And it was something that I kind of fell into a little bit, in that this MRI, you know, the imaging of the heart was really in its infancy. And one of my professors in London, John Deanfield, took me aside one day and said, Orla, I want to do some cardiac MRI. And I went, oh my God, what does he want me to do? This is physics. This is the kind of imaging that I just can't see myself doing. He said, I want you to leave what you're doing for 6 months and take this super seriously. So I was sent off to do imaging physics in in University College London. I was completely in over my head. I was struggling to get images, struggling to do everything. But actually, it was amazing because, you know, axial imaging now is a part of how we look at the heart. We look at it using MRI, particularly in children, because we don't want to expose them to radiation. We use a lot of CT as well. And I suppose it was one of the things that, and fetal cardiology, which I was doing an awful lot of, that opened a door for me here, because I found myself having a skill set that other people didn't have. Colin McMahon, who was appointed a few years before me, had, you know, essentially he blazed the trail. People understood that there was something very, very valuable in this kind of imaging, and suddenly they couldn't get enough of it. And so I found myself kind of an accidental MRI cardiologist in the right place at the right time. And so I came back.
And then getting into what you actually do, you, and we've spoken a little bit before we started the interview about the two big time points that you encounter patients. It's usually during fetal life and shortly after delivery, and then again, maybe towards the late teens.
For us in cardiology, the main time point at which major diagnosis is made now is in the minus. It's in the before you're born. And you know what? In Ireland, we're very, very good at it. And over the last 3 years, 85% of kids who have complex heart disease that's going to need surgery in the first 6 weeks, without which they would probably not survive, will have that diagnosis made prenatally. So when you're rocking up as a pregnant mom who's 22 weeks pregnant and having a fetal cardiac scan, you can have confidence in what is a very well set up system with sonographers who are trained to a very high level and who are working alongside consultants, maternal fetal medicine groups, who I would say have just got extraordinarily well organized setups. And when they are worried and they see an abnormality, then those ladies, those families come in to see me. And I do clinics in the Coombe and in the Rotunda. They are, for me, super interesting because it's difficult imaging on, you know, fetuses who are in whatever position they choose to be in on the day. They're showing you their spine, they're inside out, they're upside down. It's super, super interesting. But, you know, I wouldn't want to come to one of my clinics, because if you come, you have a 90% chance of leaving knowing that your baby has a life-changing cardiac diagnosis, and that that is going to require, you know, substantial emotional time investment and elevate the demands on you as a parent to a level that you didn't know existed. And I often say to parents when they meet me and I'm telling them what it's going to be like, and they look at me like with one, you know, eyebrow elevated going, yeah, it's not going to be that bad. I say to them sometimes, I don't have the words to help you to understand how difficult this is going to be. And the impact it's going to have on your relationship with your baby, your relationship with your partner, and also very importantly, your relationship on your other children. And, you know, keeping that all together and trying to bring everybody with you and not allowing, you know, siblings to get lost, partners to get lost along the way is a huge challenge for families.
You've touched on a very important aspect of what you do as a physician. You're not just giving the diagnosis, you're also managing the implications of that diagnosis and really counseling the parents as well as to what that means for them down the line. So it's very interesting because I think a lot of people don't realize that. Just to put it in context, how common are those conditions?
Well, your heart is very complex, and it's the organ system in your body that's most likely to go wrong. So next year, in Ireland, with our 66,000 births, about 400-450 children will be born with a very substantial cardiac problem that demands that they are treated, otherwise they will not enjoy long-term health and well-being. And so therefore it's the most common structural problem, and it can occur on its own or it can occur as part of a genetic syndrome. Super common, super complex. We're getting better and better at dealing with stuff, but, you know, in so doing, we take on a patient, but we also take on a family, and the family takes on an entire change in their lifestyle. You know, if we, for those of us who are parents, you understand the enormous, indescribable, I suppose, you know, explosion that is parenthood. Nobody can tell you about parenthood. You have to live it. You have to live the challenges of feeding a baby at 2 o'clock in the morning. You have to live looking at your partner and going, I don't know what to do. Do you know what to do? To do that with a child who has complex heart disease is to multiply it by a factor of 100, because you are a parent whose child is sick, who is subject to deteriorations in their health that are sometimes sudden and unexpected. And that kid is depending on you to notice the small stuff and to action that small stuff and to get in there on time. And parents do like an extraordinary job, but they do so at enormous cost to their own sense of self, to their own life. Like I often say to them, you know, we need to give us the next 6 months in its entirety and plan to do nothing. Plan to just get through the next 6 months, and at the end of it, let's have a child who's gone through stage one, stage two surgery, who's alive and who is now enjoying a good quality of life. But in order to do that, you're going to have to park almost everything else that you value. You know, and for women in particular, I think it's very hard. When we look at our women who have babies with complex heart disease, we know that for the first 18 months, most of them won't work. We know that, you know, we hear about, you know, women, what defines us? What defines us is, you know, it makes us autonomous and independent and lovely. You know, we have a sense of self. We have a sense of identity through work. We develop a sense of identity sometimes through motherhood. But if you have a child with complex heart disease, the whole work bit just gets parked. You know, your financial independence gets parked. Suddenly families might find that they were able to cope on two incomes and pay the mortgage, and now they're struggling.
You've outlined how challenging that, you know, being in this specialty is, and what a diagnosis of congenital heart disease carries. On the other side, though, especially for parents, you hear the term murmur all the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And an innocent murmur as mm-hmm. well. So before we move on to what we're going to talk about next, can you just explain to us what a murmur is?
Okay, a murmur is just a noise. So when a doctor is listening to a child's heart, they can hear the sounds of the valves closing. Bum, ba, bum, bum, ba, bum. And that's all they expect to hear. And any additional finding other than bum, ba, bum, we describe as a murmur. And a murmur may, of course, be indicative of the fact that your baby has a significant problem. It may be that the baby has a problem with a valve, a hole in the heart, all the things we read and hear about. But in the majority of kids who look extremely well and who are thriving and who are growing, that murmur is simply a benign finding. And I suppose the way I try to explain it to parents is, when you're standing next to a stream, you can hear the water flow. And in, you hear it just bubbling through. And in small, skinny little kids with fast heart rates who are running around the place or who have a fever and you've come in to see their doctor for that reason, we hear blood just slosh through the heart. Whereas the adults and the older kids, they're the equivalent of rivers. It's a bigger volume, but much slower flow. And so we don't hear it. So those extra babbling little noises that we hear in kids, we describe as murmurs, which of course may be significant and children need to be seen in relation to murmurs. But in the majority of healthy, gorgeous toddlers, you have a murmur. That's exactly what they are, healthy and gorgeous. And I would reassure parents that doctors get that right, in that when we look at our kids who come in with a letter that we triage as low priority, in other words, where a primary care physician looks at a child and says, you know, I'm looking at this lovely, healthy child. It's healthy, it's well grown, it's meeting all its milestones. Yes, I can hear a murmur, but I think it sounds innocent. Those kids will sometimes wait a bit to see us. And so you're going to go, oh gosh, is anybody being disadvantaged by this? So we took the opportunity over the last few years to look at the kids who their primary care physician thought had an innocent flow murmur and to say, well, do you get it right? Did they get it right? And the answer is, in 98% of cases, they got it right.
And just to put that in context, I struggle to think of a screening test that has that much accuracy, you know, of actually accurately identifying 98% of cases. So that's a pretty good thing to actually reassure. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, and I think it's, you know, it's important that parents are confident. I find the primary care group in Ireland, you know, they're good. And I also, what I like about them is if they're not happy, they pick up the phone, they talk to us. And we're delighted. That didn't happen to me when I worked in the UK. But people will ring me and they will say, I've just examined this child, I'm not in the least bit happy. And you go, yeah. Okay. But they're right. And so I think people are well looked after from a cardiovascular perspective in relation to kids' heart disease in Ireland. And I would reassure them of that.
Let's fast forward 12 to 14 years, because a lot of the work that you do as well is looking at kids in their early teens and early adolescence. And that can constitute a lot of the work that you do. What are the issues that are relevant to kids of that age, and what should parents be aware of?
I suppose a lot of what we do at that age is that we reassure the parents of teenagers who are sporty and active and invested in their health, but are experiencing symptoms that might represent heart disease. A lot of what we do is about reassuring people that everything is okay.
So what could those symptoms be?
Okay, so the most common one we see in boys is chest pain. Chest pain in growing teenagers is super, super common. Cardiac chest pain, angina, is very rare, even in children that we know have heart disease. And so as kids grow and stretch, and particularly boys, because they grow so quickly, what you find is that sometimes children will develop, and teenagers will develop, short, sharp, central chest pain that's not provoked by exercise. It's really sharp, it's really severe, it winds them. They crouch down, they can't take a deep breath. It lasts a matter of seconds, and then it's gone. It's gone as soon as it comes. Super common in teenagers. It's a very benign finding, and there's excellent data now from multiple surveys involving tens of thousands of kids that these boys will be fine. But of course, the kids who come in are often super sporty, super active. They come from families who are very invested in maintaining their children's long-term cardiac health. And so we see them. We see them and we do the screening and we make sure that there's nothing else going on. And we know from all of our own data, we know from the worldwide literature that there's something else going on in less than 2% of these kids. So that's the boys. The girls, and also to a lesser extent the boys, tend to experience problems with fainting. So we know as you go through puberty, 1 in 6 teenagers will faint. We know the peak ages for fainting is around 15, 15 and a half. It's a little bit more common in girls than in boys. And in girls, sometimes it happens badly when it's leading up to a period. And it can be really, really hard on those girls for a number of years, where they stand up in school in a hot class, they feel kind of faint, they're going to have to sit down. They may faint in front of their friends, which is anyone who has a teenager will know is something they find profoundly distressing and embarrassing, because you know there's nothing worse than waking up on the floor with everybody staring at you. So we see a lot of kids like this, again, to screen for heart disease and make sure it's not there, which by and large it isn't, and also to try to help families have a practical management plan about how to navigate their way through the next few years, because it's going to take a little bit of time before this unwinds. And of course, in so doing, sometimes we pick stuff up. Sometimes we pick up unexpected, rare stuff in teenagers. But by and large, the complex stuff that we see in kids, they're born with. For children with symptoms of fainting, chest pain, they're by and large, they're a healthy group. But, you know, every single parent in Ireland is completely worried, and rightly so, about the risk of sudden death. It's something that we all really worry about. We've all stood at the sidelines watching our kids get very flushed in the face or come off a pitch looking white and because they've given it their all. And we think, oh my God, could there be something happening here? And, you know, finding those kids who have that risk because of heart muscle disease, because of inherited rhythm problems, that's something, again, in the teenage group we are super invested in doing. And I have colleagues who do little else and who do it very well. And so there's very good screening available for that should you have any red flags at all in your history where, you know, you think you might need to come in and for us to have a second look. We will look, and hopefully our objective will be to get you back on the pitch. That's where we want you to be. We want to do the testing, reassure you and get you back out there with confidence.
And other than chest pain in boys and fainting in girls, are there any other red flags?
We don't like any events relating to swimming or cold water immersion. They can be related very much to rhythm problems. We don't like it when we hear that a child was running and then they dropped. You know, most kids run, feel a bit unwell, look white in the face, get to the edge of the pitch and then they drop. That's a more benign phenomenon. We can be worried if we hear that this occurs in the context of a family history. The other interesting thing, Afif, is that the dynamic is changing a little bit and that, you know, there used to be a lot of issue in relation to exercise, but now we realise that some of that is adrenaline release. And so now, for example, there are certain arrhythmias like CPVTs that are well described in boys playing video games. you know, tragically and suddenly, a boy who has been invested and, you know, excited about a video game may drop, may have a syncopal event, anything like that. There are certain things where red flag. We need to see this child. We need to, you know, go through this with a fine tooth comb and try to find those kids and preserve their health.
You've brought this up again before we started the interview. Has wearable technology changed how these teenagers present?
It certainly has. You know, people are super invested in their health. Teenagers, very, very sporty. Like, we're so lucky in Ireland. Sport is available. It's accessible. You know, we're hard on ourselves, I think, as a nation, but there are some things we do extraordinarily well. And one of the things we do extraordinarily well is that the GAA brought sport that was affordable and accessible into people's local communities. Okay, they were the first to do it. They flew the flag, they set the standard, and other sports have followed. And that is fantastic. Because when I ask about sport and sports participation in children here in Ireland, I get a totally different answer than I used to get in other places that I've worked. Everybody is playing sports. Children are playing multiple sports, and they can do it because it's cheap, it's accessible, it's community driven, it's in their own locale. That is fantastic. And part of that is that they want to see, well, how well am I doing? So, you know, can I get an Apple Watch for Christmas, please? I'm going to put my Apple Watch on. I'm going to wear, you know, a digital health technology, and I'm going to see, you know, how fantastic I am. The problem is the digital health technology is out there. It's being worn by children. We're not quite there yet in terms of having the AI, having the tools to filter out the huge amount of data that comes off of these devices and to say, well, actually, this symptom, this finding in you is significant. So I find that, I suppose, a new reason for teenagers presenting now is that they are wearing a digital health piece of technology. And as a consequence of this, they are getting a reading on that they are don't understand, and that's causing them concern. And even when it occurs in the absence of symptoms, they're kind of going, okay, is this okay? Am I okay to proceed? So again, an awful lot of it is about giving teenagers permission to proceed. You know, we are super invested as a department in getting kids out there.
One analogy that I draw and freaked me out the first time I did this was, we often use adult ECG machines to get the electrical tracing of the babies, the electrical heart tracing of the babies. And when you apply an adult machine on a baby, the first thing that comes is like heart attack.
Anterior MI.
Yeah. And I remember the first time running to you saying, this kid is having a heart attack, Dr. Franklin. You know,
this toddler's having an anterior MI, and then you look and it says standardized for a 50-year-old male.
Exactly.
And we need to remember that. You know, I actually am a big fan of these things. And I think, you know, the onus is on us with doctors to engage with digital health technology, because it's here, it's not going away. And we need to try to make it as appropriate and as relevant for our parents and our patients as possible. But it is a challenge at the moment for us in pediatrics, because it's very much, you know, I suppose the algorithms are pushed in the region of 50-year-old males. They'll tell 14-year-olds are having atrial fibrillation, which they're not. And so it is important sometimes that people come in and just have that second opinion. We're happy to provide it.
Yeah, and it's I think, reassuring that you are not saying don't wear them, but you're actually engaging with people to learn from them, I suppose, and 100%. Understand them better.
I think it would be about as relevant as me saying, you know, put your phone down and don't look at it. These are part of our lives now. And actually, it's going to intensify. It's only going to increase. More and more people are going to wear them. These devices do have benefit. The challenge is just extrapolating the relevant data from the sea of data that's in there. But, you know, people are invested in doing this. And, you know, and it's important that we engage with people and take them seriously. You know, we want to give and empower people. Like, all of this is about people who are invested in their health. Why would I want to take that away from them? They're putting these devices on because they want to know, you know, what their sleep cycle is like. Super important. They want to know what their max heart rate is when they're exercising. This is all super important. I wouldn't want to take that away. I just want to work with them to make it relevant and to work for them to make sure that it isn't anxiety generating.
Then on a similar topic, despite the availability of sports in Ireland, we are seeing an increase in the rates of obesity here. Mm-hmm. In children. And we know that optimizing your cardiovascular health, I think, is one of the biggest avenues to longevity, but also a good quality of life.
For sure.
So how do we reconcile that?
I suppose, you know, we know that cardiovascular disease, and by that I mean death from coronary artery disease and stroke, is the most common killer in Ireland. In 8 out of 10 people who will have a problem relating to their cardiovascular health, part of the contributor is a modifiable disease factor. So they have high blood pressure, they're obese, they are sedentary, they're highly stressed, their alcohol consumption is unacceptable. They're doing something that they could change, that they could take ownership of. And we know now that as parents, we are to an extent the custodian of our long-term children's cardiovascular health. Because everything we are doing as we raise our kids is laying the foundations for their long-term health. Some excellent data from Finland that looked at teenagers with a modifiable risk factor. And it looked at kids in their teenagers, 14 plus, and said, okay, let's find kids who are hypertensive, kids who are obese, kids who are not exercising enough. Let's follow these kids into their 50s and let's see who's going to get heart disease. And the answer is, if you have modifiable risk factors as a teen, you are beginning the inflammatory process then, even though you won't manifest the clinical disease until you're 40 or 50, you're going to engage in a long pre-clinical kind of lead-in into the disease where if you change, things can change. And so again, I think super important not to talk down to people, not to tell them, okay, this is a disaster, you are overweight, you must change things. We need to say, well, you need to change things because although it may not be causing a problem for you now, you are sowing the seeds of long-term cardiovascular ill health. And I do not want you to be a 55-year-old who has its first MI. And these are the kind of things that we can do to try to help you. And, you know, the good thing is that the help we can give, it's like compound interest. I don't know if you're into James Clear or any of these guys who think about how we think. I'm moderately obsessed by it and everybody in my family laughs at me. But, you know, there is compound interest in terms of small changes. And if we make small changes in terms of going for in 2 walks a week, you know, taking that run, you know, cutting back our alcohol intake, don't smoke, don't vape, we have, over a period of decades, we are going to reap enormous rewards and benefits from it. And it's something we can and should be encouraged to do for ourselves.
And bringing it back to kids, then, in your opinion, what is the most common modifiable risk factor that you are beginning to address now? Is it diet? Is it lack of exercise? Or is it a combination of both?
I think it is a combination of both. And I think the first thing is, you know, we need to understand that there are huge challenges. We have a huge problem with, you know, accommodation and homelessness in this country. And it's very hard for people to do the kind of things I'm talking about, to engage in the community, to get embedded, to join your GAA team. You don't have a home address. You know, so there are lots of things that are that in a lot of the families I see, they are really struggling. And the other thing that they're struggling with making food choices in relation to favoring healthy foods that might be more costly. You know, and at a time when it's difficult to put petrol in their cars, they're cutting back in other ways. And it's difficult for them to understand that bulk doesn't equal good. You know, there's a good quote. There's a guy called, I think his name's Alan Greggs, and he was in the early part of the 21st century. He talked about as humans, we've had hundreds of thousands of years learning to cope with adversity. The challenge now is to learn to be healthy in prosperity. The challenge is to say, okay, your children are by and large not going to go hungry, but they need to think about portion sizes. We need to make the best food choices we can in relation to what we put on their plates. And then after that, we all need to go out and do some exercise. And, you know, that's hard work. And that involves investment of time and energy in families. And they can only do that when other stresses, like accommodation, jobs, you know, when those stresses are taken away, then you'll find that they have more time to engage in familial cardiovascular health.
This has been an amazing conversation, and I just want to ask you a couple of more questions, if that's okay. The first one is, how much has pediatric cardiology advanced over the last 10 years?
When I started out, there were a whole group of conditions from which children routinely died. To get that diagnosis in infancy and in young adult life was essentially a death sentence. That is no longer the case. There is a huge amount of work we can do now in terms of working with surgeons and interventional cardiologists to optimize the cardiovascular health, even of our sickest patients. And we're also now very invested in the idea of inherited cardiovascular disease, in, you know, teasing out those families, those children who are likely to develop something based on genetic complement that, again, we can help them modify and we can significantly reduce risk in relation to. So, you know, the wards that were built originally in Crumlin were built on the basis of the fact that the children who occupy them, from a heart perspective, many of them are going to die because there wasn't an awful lot that could be done. And the wards that are there now, when I came back first from England, one of the things that struck me was how absolutely miserable the wards were, how very little space there was. And how we needed to change that landscape so the parents could come in, be with their kids, be adjacent to them in a way that was comfortable, that supported the family, that didn't bankrupt them as they paid for hospital canteen food, but allowed them to, you know, have their own healthy kitchen and to cook for themselves in the ward environment. There were loads that I felt that we could do to make things better. And thankfully in Crumlin, we've done that in relation to the Children's Heart Centre there. And it's going to be done again in the new Children's Hospital. But, you know, cardiovascular disease in children is no longer a death sentence. It is something from which most will survive and thrive and go on and live long and healthy lives. And I'm, I suppose, very proud to be part of a team that does that. We have a great team in Crumlin. We have like super surgeons, amazing intensivists, an extraordinary bunch of nurses. And a group on the ward, from the HCAs to the cleaners to the hospital visitors, like there is an extraordinary, there's a kindness there. There's a kindness and an empathy that I haven't seen in other places. And again, I feel strongly that there are things we do really well as Irish people, and that's something we need to call out.
I think it's important to add that we have some of the best, if not the best, surgeons and paediatric cardiologists in the world. And I'm not just saying that because you are here, but it's just because they deal with so much variety that other places may not see.
There's no doubt. And I would hate to, you know, further increase the ego of my surgical colleagues. And in fact, actually, one of the reasons Crumlin works so well is that I work with three surgeons who have very little ego. They're extraordinarily gifted, talented guys who could work anywhere.
And they are so approachable. I mean, I can pick up the phone and just call them.
Yeah, they're great.
With a query, and they'd have no problem.
Nope.
You know?
No, and, you know, they are operating to the most amazingly high level, but also there's a concentration of expertise because they're seeing an awful lot. You know, we have a very big program. There are programs in Europe that are having to downscale. Surgeons are having to operate in pairs. Our challenge is to get the kids through. There is a volume of disease there in Ireland because, and it must be said, because a lot of the time parents continue pregnancies that wouldn't necessarily be continued all over Europe and support children where that support might not otherwise be given. And what that results in is a big volume of patients, a concentration of expertise in Crumlin, and an extraordinary ability on the part of interventional cardiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons and the extraordinary multidisciplinary team that supports them to get these kids over the line.
And finally, what can be done to better help inform parents on how to optimize their children's cardiovascular health?
I think a huge amount of it needs to be community-based. And I think that there are certainly areas and communities where people need special help in relation to making choices in relation to diet and exercise. And like special proper supported help, communities that they can go in, they can discuss. Because you find that if you make these facilities available to people, they do come, they do turn up. They are super invested. It's just sometimes they might know the way. So I think a big part of it now is to empower people to make healthy choices through education that is resourced well and locally based. And, you know, that's the whole thing for me. As I said, there isn't a tablet for a lot of the acquired cardiovascular disease. A lot of it is about people deciding that they're going to make those changes and us as a medical community. And, you know, then the bigger part of the community supporting people as they make those choices and make those changes.
Orla, thank you so much for coming on the Baby Trap podcast.
Oh, I was delighted to be here. Thanks a million.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guides in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.